Light filtered into the deep room from tiny barred windows up near the roof. There was no way out except by walking through the several hundred tons of stone that blocked the tunnel, or to put it another way, which was the way Rincewind put it, they were undoubtedly trapped. He relaxed a bit. At least there was no mistaking the magic carpet. It lay rolled up on a raised slab in the middle of the room. Next to it was a small, sleek oil lamp, and, Rincewind craned to see, a small gold ring. He groaned. A faint octarine corona hung over all three items, indicating that they were magical. When Kanina unrolled the carpet, a number of small objects tumbled to the floor, including a brass herring, a wooden ear, a few large square sequins, and a lead box with a preserved soap bubble in it.
"What on earth are they?" said Nigel.
"Well," said Rincewind, "before they tried to eat that carpet, they were probably moths."
"Gosh! That's what you people never understand," said Rincewind wearily. "You think magic is just something you can pick up and use like a, parsnip?"
said Nigel.
"Wine bottle?"
said the Seraph. "Something like that," said Rincewind cautiously, but rallied somewhat and went on, "But the truth is
not like that."
"More like a wine bottle," said the Seraph hopefully.
"Magic uses people," said Rincewind hurriedly. "It affects you as much as you affect it, sort of thing. You can't mess around with magical things without it affecting you. I just thought I'd better warn you."
"Like a wine bottle," said Creosote.
That drinks you back," said Rincewind. "So you can put down that lamp and ring for a start, and for goodness sake don't rub anything."
"My grandfather built up the family fortunes with them," said Creosote wistfully. "His wicked uncle locked him in a cave, you know. He had to set himself up with what came to hand. He had nothing in the world but a magic carpet, a magic lamp, a magic ring, and a grotto full of assorted jewels."
"Came up the hard way, did he?" said Rincewind. Kanina spread the carpet on the floor. It had a complex pattern of golden dragons on a blue background. They were extremely complicated dragons, with long beards, ears, and wings, and they seemed to be frozen in motion, caught in the transition from one state to another, suggesting that the loom which wove them had rather more dimensions than the usual three. But the worst thing about it was that if you looked at it long enough, the pattern became blue dragons on a gold background, and a terrible feeling stole over you that if you kept on trying to see both types of dragon at once, your brains would trickle out of your ears. Rincewind tore his gaze away with some difficulty as another distant explosion rocked the building. "How does it work?" he said. Creosote shrugged.
"I've never used it," he said. "I suppose you just say up and down and things like that."
"How about fly through the wall?" said Rincewind.
All three of them looked up at the high, dark, and above all solid walls of the room.
"We could try sitting on it and saying rise," Nigel volunteered, "and then before we hit the roof we could say, well, stop."
He considered this for a bit and then added, "if that's the word."
"Or drop," said Rincewind, "or descend, dive, fall, sink, or plunge."
"Plummet," suggested Kanina gloomily.
"Of course," said Nigel, "with all this wild magic floating around, you could try using some of it."
"Ah," said Rincewind, "and, well..."
"You've got wizard written on your hat," said Creosote.
"Anyone can write things on their hat," said Kanina. "You don't want to believe everything you read."
"Now hold on a minute," said Rincewind hotly.
They held on a minute. They held on for a further 17 seconds.
"Look, it's a lot harder than you think," he said.
"What did I tell you?" said Kanina. "Come on, let's dig the mortar out with our fingernails." Rincewind waved her into silence, removed his hat, pointedly blew the dust off the star, put the hat on again, adjusted the brim, rolled up his sleeves, flexed his fingers, and panicked. In default of anything better to do, he leaned against the stone. It was vibrating. It wasn't that it was being shaken, it felt that the throbbing was coming from inside the wall. It was very much the same sort of trembling that he had felt back at the university just before the sorcerer had arrived. The stone was definitely very unhappy about something. He sidled along the wall and put his ear to the next stone, which was a smaller, wedge-shaped stone cut to fit an angle of the wall. Not a big distinguished stone, but a bantam stone, patiently doing its bit for the greater good of the wall as a whole. It was also shaking.
"Shush!" said Kanina. "I can't hear anything," said Nigel loudly.
Nigel was one of those people who, if you say, "Don't look now," would immediately swivel his head like an owl on a turntable. These are the same sort of people who, when you point out, say, an unusual crocus just beside them, turn around aimlessly and put their foot down with a sad little squashy noise. If they were lost in a trackless desert, you could find them by putting down somewhere on the sand something small and fragile, like a valuable old mug that has been in your family for generations, and then hurrying back as soon as you heard the crash. Anyway, that's the point. What happened to the war? A little cascade of mortar poured down from the ceiling onto Rincewind's hat. "Something's acting on the stones," he said quietly. "They're trying to break free."
"We're right underneath quite a lot of them," observed Creosote.
There was a grinding noise above them, and a shaft of daylight lanced down. To Rincewind's surprise, it wasn't accompanied by sudden death from crushing. There was another silicon creak, and the hole grew. The stones were falling out, and they were falling up. "I think," he said, "that the carpet might be worth a try at this point." The wall beside him shook itself like a dog and drifted apart, its masonry giving Rincewind several severe blows as it soared away. The four of them landed on the blue and gold carpet in a storm of flying rock. "We've got to get out of here," said Nigel, keeping up his reputation for acute observation. "Hang on," said Rincewind. "I'll say..."
"You won't," snapped Kanina, kneeling beside him. "I'll say.
I don't trust you.
But you've..."
"Shut up," said Kanina. She patted the carpet.
"Carpet, rise," she commanded.
There was a pause.
"Up."
"Perhaps it doesn't understand the language," said Nigel.
"Lift. Levitate. Fly."
"Or it could be, say, sensitive to one particular voice."
"Shut up."
"You tried up," said Nigel. "Try ascend."
"Or soar,"
said Creosote. Several tons of flagstone swooped past an inch from his head. "If it was going to answer to them, it would have done, wouldn't it?" said Kanina. The air around her was thick with dust as the flying stones ground together. She thumped the carpet.
"Take off, you blasted mat! Urgh!"
A piece of cornice clipped her shoulder. She rubbed the bruise irritably and turned to Rincewind, who was sitting with his knees under his chin and his hat pulled over his head.
"Why doesn't it work?" she said.
"You're not saying the right words," he said.
"It doesn't understand the language. Language hasn't got anything to do with it. You've neglected something fundamental."
"Well?"
"Well what?" sniffed Rincewind. "Look, this isn't time to stand on your dignity. You keep on trying. You don't mind me."
"Make it fly."
Rincewind pulled his hat further over his ears.
"Please?" said Kanina.
The hat rose a bit.
"We'd all be terribly bucked," said Nigel.
"Hear, hear,"
said Creosote. The hat rose some more. "You're quite sure?" said Rincewind.
"Yes."
Rincewind cleared his throat.
"Down," he commanded.
The carpet rose from the ground and hovered expectantly a few feet over the dust.
"How did you..."
Kanina began, but Nigel interrupted her.
"Wizards are privy to arcane knowledge. That's probably what it is," he said. "Probably the carpet's got a gears on it to do the opposite of anything that's said. Can you make it go up further?"
"Yes, but I'm not going to," said Rincewind. The carpet drifted slowly forward, and as happens so often at times like this, a rolling slab of masonry bounced right across the spot where it had lain. A moment later they were out in the open air, the storm of stone behind them. The palace was pulling itself to pieces, and the pieces were funnelling up into the air like a volcanic eruption in reverse. The sorcerous tower had completely disappeared, but the stones were dancing towards the spot where it had stood, and...
"They're building another tower," said Nigel.
"Out of my palace, too," said Creosote.
"The hat's won," said Rincewind. "That's why it's building its own tower. It's a sort of reaction. Wizards always used to build a tower around themselves. Like those, what do you call those things you find at the bottom of rivers?
Frogs? Stones? Unsuccessful gangsters?"
"Caddis flies is what I meant," said Rincewind. "When a wizard set out to fight, the first thing he always did was build a tower."
"It's very big," said Nigel.
Rincewind nodded glumly.
"Where are we going?"
said Kanina. Rincewind shrugged.
"Away," he said.
The outer palace wall drifted just below them. As they passed over it began to shake, and small bricks began to loop towards the storm of flying rock that buzzed around the new tower. Eventually Kanina said, "All right, how did you get the carpet to fly? Does it really do the opposite of what you command?" "No, I just paid attention to certain fundamental details of laminar and spatial arrangements." "You've lost me there," she admitted. "You wanted in non-wizard talk?" "Yes." "You put it on the floor upside down," said Rincewind. Kanina sat very still for a while. Then she said, "I must say this is very comfortable. It's the first time I've ever flown on a carpet." "It's the first time I've ever flown one," said Rincewind vaguely. "You do it very well," she said. "Thank you. You said you were frightened of heights."
"Terrified."
"You don't show it."
"I'm not thinking about it."
Rincewind turned and looked at the tower behind them. It had grown quite a lot in the last minute, blossoming at the top into a complexity of turrets and battlements. A swarm of tiles was hovering over it, individual tiles swooping down and clinking into place like ceramic bees on a bombing run. It was impossibly high. The stones at the bottom would have been crushed if it wasn't for the magic that crackled through them. Well, that was just about it as far as organized wizardry was concerned. 2,000 years of peaceful magic had gone down the drain, the towers were going up again, and with all this raw magic floating around, something was going to get very seriously hurt. Probably the universe. Too much magic could wrap time and space around itself, and that wasn't good news for the kind of person who had grown used to things like effects following things like causes. And of course it would be impossible to explain things to his companions. They didn't seem to grasp ideas properly. More particularly, they didn't seem to be able to get the hang of doom. They suffered from the terrible delusion that something could be done. They seemed prepared to make the world the way they wanted it, or die in the attempt. And the trouble with dying in the attempt was that you died in the attempt. The whole point about the old university organization was that it kept a sort of peace between wizards who got along with one another about as easily as cats in a sack. And now the gloves were off, anyone who tried to interfere was going to end up severely scratched. This wasn't the old, gentle, rather silly magic that the disc was used to. This was magic war, white-hot and searing. Rincewind wasn't very good at precognition. In fact, he could barely see into the present. But he knew with weary certainty that at some point in the very near future, like 30 seconds or so, someone would say, "Surely there's something we could do." The desert passed below them, lit by the low rays of the setting sun.
"There don't seem to be many stars," said Nigel. "Perhaps they're scared to come out."
Rincewind looked up. There was a silver haze high in the air. "It's raw magic settling out of the atmosphere," he said. "It's saturated. 27, 28, 29,
surely there's something we—"
Kanina began. "There isn't," said Rincewind flatly, but with just the faintest twinge of satisfaction. "The wizards will fight each other until there's one victor. There isn't anything else anyone can do."
"I could do with a drink," said Creosote. "I suppose we couldn't stop somewhere where I could buy an inn."
"What with?" said Nigel. "You're poor, remember?"
"Poor, I don't mind," said the Seraph. "It's sobriety that is giving me difficulties."
Kanina prodded Rincewind gently in the ribs.
"Are you steering this thing?" she said.
"No."
"Then where is it going?"
Nigel peered downwards.
"By the look of it," he said, "it's going hubwards, towards the Circled Sea."
"Someone must be guiding it."
"Hello," said a friendly voice in Rincewind's head.
"You're not my conscience again, are you?" thought Rincewind. "I'm feeling really bad."
"Well, I'm sorry," Rincewind thought, "but none of this is my fault. I'm just a victim of circuses. I don't see why I should take the blame."
"Yes, but you could do something about it."
"Like what?"
"You could destroy the sorcerer. All this would collapse then."
"I wouldn't stand a chance."
"Then at least you could die in the attempt. That might be preferable to letting magical war break out."
"Oh, look, just shut up, will you?" said Rincewind.
"What?" said Kanina.
Said Rincewind vaguely.
He looked down blankly at the blue and gold pattern underneath him and added,
"You're flying this, aren't you? Through me. That's sneaky."
"What are you talking about?"
"Oh, sorry. Talking to myself."
"I think," said Kanina, "that we'd better land." They glided down towards a crescent of beach where the desert reached the sea. In normal light it would have been blinding white with a sand made up of billions of tiny shell fragments, but at this time of day it was blood red and primordial. Ranks of driftwood, carved by the waves and bleached by the sun, were piled up on the tide line like the bones of ancient fish or the biggest floral art accessory counter in the universe. Nothing stirred apart from the waves. There were a few rocks around, but they were fire-brick hot and home to no mollusk or seaweed. Even the sea looked arid. If any proto-amphibian emerged onto a beach like this, it would have given up there and then, gone back into the water, and told all its relatives to forget the legs, it wasn't worth it. The air felt as though it had been cooked in a sock. Even so, Nigel insisted that they light a fire. "It's more friendly," he said. "Besides, there could be monsters." Kanina looked at the oily wavelets rolling up the beach in what appeared to be a half-hearted attempt to get out of the sea. "In that," she said, "you never can tell." Rincewind mooched along the waterline, distractedly picking up stones and throwing them in the sea. One or two were thrown back. After a while, Kanina got a fire going, and the bone-dry, salt-saturated wood sent blue and green flames roaring up under a fountain of sparks. The wizard went and sat in the dancing shadows, his back against a pile of whitened wood, wrapped in a cloud of such impenetrable gloom that even Creosote stopped complaining of thirst and shut up. Kanina woke up after midnight. There was a crescent moon on the horizon, and a thin, chilly mist covered the sand. Creosote was snoring on his back. Nigel, who was theoretically on guard, was sound asleep. Kanina lay perfectly still, every sense seeking out the thing that had woken her. Finally, she heard it again. It was a tiny, diffident, clinking noise, barely audible above the muted slurp of the sea. She got up, or rather, she slid into the vertical as bonelessly as a jellyfish, and flicked Nigel's sword out of his unresisting hand. Then she sidled through the mist without causing so much as an extra swirl. The fire sank down further into its bed of ash. After a while, Kanina came back and shook the other two awake.
"Where is it?"
"I think you ought to see this," she hissed. "I think it could be important." "I just shut my eyes for a second," Nigel protested. "Never mind about that. Come on."
Creosote squinted around the impromptu campsite.
"Where's the wizard fellow?"
"You'll see. And don't make a noise. It could be dangerous."
They stumbled after her, knee-deep in vapour, towards the sea. Eventually, Nigel said,
"Why dangerous?"
"Shh! Did you hear it?"
Nigel listened. "Like a sort of ringing noise?"
"Watch."
Rincewind walked jerkily up the beach, carrying a large round rock in both hands. He walked past them without a word, his eyes staring straight ahead. They followed him along the cold beach until he reached a bare area between the dunes, where he stopped and, still moving with all the grace of a clothes horse, dropped the rock. It made a clinking noise. There was a wide circle of other stones. Very few of them had actually stayed on top of another one. The three of them crouched down and watched him.
"Is he asleep?"
said Creosote. Kanina nodded.
"What's he trying to do?"
"I think he's trying to build a tower."
Rincewind lurched back into the ring of stones and, with great care, placed another rock on empty air. It fell down.
"He's not very good at it, is he?" said Nigel.
"It is very sad," said Creosote.
"Maybe we ought to wake him up," said Kanina. "Only I heard that if you wake up a sleepwalker, their legs fall off or something. What do you think?"
"Could be risky with wizards," said Nigel.
They tried to make themselves comfortable on the chilly sand.
"It's rather pathetic, isn't it?" said Creosote. "It's not as if he's really a proper wizard."
Kanina and Nigel tried to avoid one another's gaze. Finally the boy coughed and said,
"I'm not exactly a barbarian hero, you know. You may have noticed."
They watched the toiling figure of Rincewind for a while, and then Kanina said,
"If it comes to that, I think I lack a certain something when it comes to hairdressing."
They both stared fixedly at the sleepwalker, busy with their own thoughts and red with mutual embarrassment. Creosote cleared his throat.
"If it makes anyone feel any better," he said, "I sometimes perceive that my poetry leaves a lot to be desired."
Rincewind carefully tried to balance a large rock on a small pebble. It fell off, but he appeared to be happy with the result.
"Speaking as a poet," said Canina carefully, "what would you say about this situation?"
Creosote shifted uneasily.
"Funny old thing life," he said.
"Pretty apt."
Nigel lay back and looked up at the hazy stars.
Then he sat bolt upright.
"Did you see that?" he demanded.
"What?"
"It was a sort of flash, a kind of..." The hubward horizon exploded into a silent flower of colour, which expanded rapidly through all the hues of the conventional spectrum before flashing into brilliant octarine. It etched itself on their eyeballs before fading away. After a while there was a distant rumble.
"Some sort of magical weapon," said Canina, blinking.
A gust of warm wind picked up the mist and streamed it past them.
"Blow this," said Nigel, getting to his feet. "I'm going to wake him up, even if it means we end up carrying him."
He reached out for Rincewind's shoulder just as something went past very high overhead, making a noise like a flock of geese on nitrous oxide. It disappeared into the desert behind them. Then there was a sound that would have set false teeth on edge, a flash of green light, and a thump.
"I'll wake him up," said Canina. "You get the carpet."
She clambered over the ring of rocks and took the sleeping wizard gently by the arm, and this would have been a textbook way of waking a somnambulist if Rincewind hadn't dropped the rock he was carrying on his foot. He opened his eyes.
"Where am I?" he said. "On the beach. You've been, dreaming."
Rincewind blinked at the mist, the sky, the circle of stones, Canina, the circle of stones again, and finally back at the sky.
"What's been happening?" he said.
"Some sort of magical fireworks."
"Oh, it started then."
He lurched unsteadily out of the circle, in a way that suggested to Canina that perhaps he wasn't quite awake yet, and staggered back towards the remains of the fire. He walked a few steps and then appeared to remember something. He looked down at his foot and said, "Ow." He'd almost reached the fire when the blast from the last spell reached them. It had been aimed at the tower in Al-Khali, which was 20 miles away, and by now the wavefront was extremely diffuse. It was hardly affecting the nature of things as it surged over the dunes with a faint sucking noise. The fire burned red and green for a second, one of Nigel's sandals turned into a small and irritated badger, and a pigeon flew out of the Seraph's turban. Then it was past, and boiling out over the sea.
"What was that?"
said Nigel. He kicked the badger, who was sniffing at his foot.
"Hmm?"
said Rincewind.
"That!"
"Oh, that," said Rincewind. "Just the backwash of a spell. They probably hit the tower in Al-Khali."
"Must have been pretty big to affect us here."
"It probably was."
"Hey, that was my palace," said Creosote weakly. "I mean, I know it was a lot, but it was all I had."
"Sorry."
"But there were people in the city."
"They're probably all right," said Rincewind.
"Good."
"Whatever they are."
"What?"
Canina grabbed his arm.
"Don't shout at him," she said. "He's not himself."
"Ah,"
said Creosote dourly.
"An improvement."
"I say, that's a bit unfair,"
Nigel protested. "I mean, he got me out of the snake pit, and, well, he knows a lot."
"Yes, wizards are good at getting you out of the sort of trouble that only wizards can get you into," said Creosote. "Then they expect you to thank them."
"Oh, I think..."
"It's got to be said,"
said Creosote, waving his hands irritably. He was briefly illuminated by the passage of another spell across the tormented sky.
"Look at that,"
he snapped.
"Oh, he means well. They all mean well. They probably all think the disc would be a better place if they were in charge. Take it from me. There's nothing more terrible than someone out to do the world a favour. Wizards. When all's said and done, what good are they? I mean, can you name me something worthwhile any wizard's done?"
"I think that's a bit cruel," said Canina, but with an edge in her voice that suggested she could be open to persuasion on the subject.
"Well, they make me sick,"
muttered Creosote, who was feeling acutely sober and didn't like it much.
"I think we'll all feel better if we try to get a bit more sleep," said Nigel diplomatically. "Things always look better by daylight. Well, nearly always, anyway."
"My mouth feels all horrible, too,"
muttered Creosote, determined to cling on to the remnant of his anger. Canina turned back to the fire and became aware of a gap in the scenery. It was Rincewind-shaped.
"He's gone."
In fact, Rincewind was already half a mile over the dark sea, squatting on the carpet like an angry Buddha, his mind a soup of rage, humiliation and fury, with a side order of outrage. He hadn't wanted much, ever. He'd stuck with wizardry, even though he wasn't any good at it. He'd always done his best, and now the whole world was conspiring against him. Well, he'd show them. Precisely who they were, and what they were going to be shown, was merely a matter of detail. He reached up and touched his hat for reassurance, even as it lost its last few sequins in the slipstream. The luggage was having problems of its own. The area around the Tower of Al-Khali, under the relentless magical bombardment, was already drifting beyond that reality horizon, where time, space and matter lose their separate identities and start wearing one another's clothes. It was quite impossible to describe. Here is what it looked like. It looked like a piano sounds shortly after being dropped down a well. It tasted yellow and felt paisley. It smelt like a total eclipse of the moon. Of course, nearer to the tower it got really weird. Expecting anything unprotected to survive in that would be like expecting snow on a supernova. Fortunately, the luggage didn't know this and slid through the maelstrom with raw magic crystallizing on its lid and hinges. It was in a foul mood, but again there was nothing very unusual about this, except that the crackling fury earthing itself spectacularly all over the luggage in a multicoloured corona gave it the appearance of an early and very angry amphibian crawling out of a burning swamp. It was hot and stuffy inside the tower. There were no internal floors, just a series of walkways around the walls. They were lined with wizards, and the central space was a column of octarine light that creaked loudly as they poured their power into it. At its base stood Abrim, the octarine gems on the hat blazing so brightly that they looked more like holes cut through into a different universe, where, in defiance of probability, they had come out inside a sun. The vizier stood with his hands out, fingers splayed, eyes shut, mouth a thin line of concentration, balancing the forces. Usually a wizard could control power only to the extent of his own physical capability, but Abrim was learning fast. You made yourself the pinch in the hourglass, the fulcrum on the balance, the roll around the sausage. Do it right, and you were the power. It was part of you, and you were capable of... Has it been pointed out that his feet were several inches off the ground? His feet were several inches off the ground. Abrim was pulling together the potency for a spell that would soar away into the sky and beset the Ankh Tower with 1,000 screaming demons when there came a thunderous knock at the door. There is a mantra to be said on these occasions. It doesn't matter if the door is a tent flap, a scrap of hide on a wind-blown yurt, 3 inches of solid oak with great iron nails in, or a rectangle of chipboard with mahogany veneer, a small light over it made of horrible bits of coloured glass and a bell push that plays a choice of 20 popular melodies that no music lover would want to listen to even after 5 years' sensory deprivation. One wizard turned to another and duly said, "I wonder who that can be at this time of night." There was another series of thumps on the woodwork. "There can't be anyone alive out there," said the other wizard. And he said it nervously, because if you ruled out the possibility of it being anyone alive, that always left the suspicion that perhaps it was someone dead. This time the banging rattled the hinges. "One of us had better go out," said the first wizard. "Good man." "Ah. Oh. Right." He set off slowly down the short arched passage. "I'll just go and see who it is, then," he said. "First class." It was a strange figure that made its hesitant way to the door. Ordinary robes weren't sufficient protection in the high-energy field inside the tower, and over his brocade and velvet the wizard wore a thick, padded overall, stuffed with rowan shavings and embroidered with industrial-grade sigils. He'd affixed a smoked-glass visor to his pointy hat, and his gauntlets, which were extremely big, suggested that he was a wicket-keeper in a game of cricket played at supersonic speeds. The actinic flashes and pulsations from the great work in the main hall cast harsh shadows around him as he fumbled for the bolts. He pulled down the visor and opened the door a fraction. "We don't want any," he began, and ought to have chosen his words better, because they were his epitaph. It was some time before his colleague noticed his continued absence, and wandered down the passage to find him. The door had been thrown wide open, the thaumatic inferno outside roaring against the web of spells that held it in check. In fact, the door hadn't been pushed completely back. He pulled it aside to see why, and gave a little whimper. There was a noise behind him. He turned around. "What?" he began, which is a pretty poor syllable on which to end a life.